carboxyhemoglobin. Throughout his youth, the young Haldane helped his father with experiments. By the time he was a teenager, the two often tested gases and gas masks together, taking turns to see how long it took them to pass out. Although J.B.S. Haldane never took a degree in science, he studied classics at Oxford, he became a brilliant scientist in his own right, mostly in Cambridge. The biologist Peter Medawar, who spent his life around mental Olympians, called him the cleverest man I ever knew. Huxley likewise parodied the younger Haldane in his novel Antic Hay, but also used his ideas on genetic manipulation of humans as the basis for the plot of Brave New World. Among many other achievements, Haldane played a central role in marrying Darwinian principles of evolution to the genetic work of Gregor Mendel to produce what is known to geneticists as the modern synthesis. Perhaps uniquely among human beings, the younger Haldane found World War I a very enjoyable experience and freely admitted that he enjoyed the opportunity of killing people. He was himself wounded twice. After the war, he became a successful popularizer of science and wrote 23 books, as well as over 400 scientific papers. His books are still thoroughly readable and instructive, though not always easy to find. He also became an enthusiastic Marxist. It has been suggested, not altogether cynically, that this was out of a purely contrarian instinct, and that if he had been born in the Soviet Union, he would have been a passionate monarchist. At all events, most of his articles first appeared in the communist Daily Worker. Whereas his father's principal interests concerned miners and poisoning, the younger Haldane became obsessed with saving submariners and divers from the unpleasant consequences of their work. With Admiralty funding, he acquired a decompression chamber that he called the pressure pot. This was a metal cylinder into which three people at a time could be sealed and subjected to tests of various types, all painful and nearly all dangerous. Volunteers might be required to sit in ice water while breathing aberrant atmosphere, or subjected to rapid changes of pressurization. In one experiment, Haldane simulated a dangerously hasty ascent to see what would happen. What happened was that the dental fillings in his teeth exploded. Almost every experiment, Norton writes, ended with someone having a seizure, bleeding, or vomiting. The chamber was virtually soundproof, so the only way for occupants to signal unhappiness or distress was to tap insistently on the chamber wall or to hold up notes to a small window. On another occasion, while poisoning himself with elevated levels of oxygen, Haldane had a fit so severe that he crushed several vertebrae. Collapsed lungs were a routine hazard. Perforated eardrums were quite common, but as Haldane reassuringly noted in one of his essays, the drum generally heals up, and if a hole remains in it, although one is somewhat deaf, one can blow tobacco smoke out of the ear in question, which is a social accomplishment. What was extraordinary about this was not that Haldane was willing to subject himself to such risk and discomfort in the pursuit of science, but that he had no trouble talking colleagues and loved ones into climbing into the chamber too. Sent on a simulated descent, his wife once had a fit that lasted 13 minutes. When at last she stopped bouncing across the floor, she was helped to her feet and sent home to cook dinner. Haldane happily employed whoever happened to be around, including on one memorable occasion a former Prime Minister of Spain, Juan Negrin. Dr. Negrin complained afterward of minor tingling and a curious velvety sensation on the lips, but otherwise seems to have escaped unharmed. He may have considered himself very lucky. A similar experiment with oxygen deprivation left Haldane without feeling in his buttocks and lower spine for 6 years. Among Haldane's many specific preoccupations was nitrogen intoxication. For reasons that are still poorly understood, beneath depths of about 100 feet, nitrogen becomes a powerful intoxicant. Under its influence, divers have been known to offer their air hoses to passing fish, or decide to try to have a smoke break. It also produced wild mood swings. In one test, Haldane noted, the subject alternated between depression and elation, at one moment begging to be decompressed because he felt bloody awful, and the next minute laughing and attempting to interfere with his colleague's dexterity test. In order to measure the rate of deterioration in the subject, a scientist had to go into the chamber with the volunteer to conduct simple mathematical tests. But after a few minutes, as Haldane later recalled, the tester was usually as intoxicated as the testee and often forgot to press the spindle of his stopwatch or to take proper notes. The cause of the inebriation is even now a mystery. It is thought that it may be the same thing that causes alcohol intoxication, but as no one knows for certain what causes that, we're none the wiser. At all events, without the greatest care, it is easy to get in trouble once you leave the surface world. Which brings us back, well, nearly, to our earlier observation that Earth is not the easiest place to be an organism, even if it is the only place. Of the small portion of the planet's surface that is dry enough to stand on, a surprisingly large amount is too hot, or cold, or dry, or steep, or lofty to be of much use to us. Partly, it must be conceded, this is our fault. In terms of adaptability, humans are pretty amazingly useless. Like most animals, we don't much like really hot places, but because we sweat so freely and easily stroke, we are especially vulnerable. In the worst circumstances, on foot, without water in a hot desert, most people will grow delirious and keel over, possibly never to rise again, in no more than 6 or 7 hours. We are no less helpless in the face of cold. Like all mammals, humans are good at generating heat, but because we are so nearly hairless, not good at keeping it. Even in quite mild weather, half the calories you burn go to keep your body warm. Of course, we can counter these frailties to a large extent by employing clothing and shelter, but even so, the portions of Earth on which we are prepared or able to live are modest indeed, just 12% of the total land area, and only 4% of the whole surface if you include the seas. Yet when you consider conditions elsewhere in the known universe, the wonder is not that we use so little of our planet, but that we have managed to find a planet that we can use even a bit of.